This is VOA News via remote. I'm Michael Brown. A day after blowing up the inter-Korean liaison center, North Korea continued to ratchet up military pressure on South Korea Wednesday, announcing the redeployment of its forces near the border and angrily rejecting Seoul's offer to send envoys to reduce tensions. Combined with its moves over the past week, North Korea has now reverse many of the achievements made during a series of historic 2018 meetings between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Amid continuous nationwide protests, U.S. President Donald Trump on Tuesday signed an executive order outlining some police reforms. In a Rose Garden ceremony, Trump said reducing crime, raising standards are not opposite goals. The president said the order will encourage police departments nationwide to adopt the highest professional standards to serve their communities. The measure also calls for certification groups to train officers on de-escalation techniques and the use of force standards. Trump did not address the linkage of systemic racism to police brutality, an issue raised by demonstrators across the country. Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called the president's order weak and said it falls sadly and seriously short of what is required to fight racial injustice and police brutality. And Beijing is back on lockdown and conducting mass testing of residents after a new cluster of COVID-19 cases in one of its largest wholesale markets was discovered. The Chinese capital went into what the state media calls wartime mode after 106 new cases were reported in Beijing's southwest district. Via remote, this is VOA News. A new study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that older people, minorities, and those with pre-existing health conditions are the most susceptible to dying from COVID-19 here in the U.S. The U.S. has recorded more than 2.1 million coronavirus cases and more than 116,000 deaths. That's far and away more than any other country. Health experts predicting tens of thousands more U.S. coronavirus deaths in the coming months. Men and women contracted COVID-19 at about the same rate, but men were more likely than women to be hospitalized, placed in intensive care, or die. Brazil reported nearly 35,000 new COVID-19 cases Tuesday. The same day, a top government official declared the outbreak there was under control. The 34,918 total. But Tuesday, the highest daily number reported so far in the South American country. Brazil, the world's number two coronavirus hotspot after the United States, fast approaching a million cases. Experts say the true numbers likely higher due to patchy testing. And the largest market in Mozambique's capital, Maputo City, will remain closed Wednesday, the final day of 3 days of sanitizing and reorganization to fight the spread of the coronavirus. The move is the beginning of the gradual temporary closing of the capital's 63 markets and 5 fairs for disinfecting, new spacing of stalls. The revamping of the market's operation also comes as the Southern African country experienced a spike in COVID-19 cases, which increased by 74 over Friday and Saturday. So far, Mozambique has confirmed just over 600 coronavirus cases and 3 deaths. The Washington Post is reporting the Justice Department filed a lawsuit blocking the publication of a memoir by former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton. The suit alleges that Bolton's work contains classified material. President Trump has already criticized Bolton for writing the memoir and hinted that it might contain falsehoods. Bolton's publisher has said that the book contains allegations of Ukraine-like transgressions and foreign policy decisions by the Trump administration. The book is set to go on sale next Tuesday under the title The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. And a man from India charged with attempting to smuggle more than 3,300 pounds of marijuana over the Peace Bridge from Canada into Buffalo in the U.S. Authorities say the arrest took place Saturday on the second major bus on that border in the past 8 days. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown. VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda announces the 2021 presidential election timetable.
The Electoral Commission did something outrageous. For a country like Uganda, where very many people don't have access to TVs, don't have access to radio stations because they are poor, how do you say that candidates are going to campaign on TV and radio?
Malawi lawyers have called for a nationwide protest today to support judicial independence. Tanzania announces the reopening of all schools by June 29th. A Kenyan policeman will face charges for brutality in enforcing COVID-19 lockdown measures. A new report says repression by Zimbabwe government is worsening, and Cameroon separatists are launching a draft to raise millions of dollars for their war effort.
We are bringing Amazonians from all the nooks and crannies of the globe together, county by county. Each county raises funds to prosecute the struggle in its county and in their local government.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Amazonian Republic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda will start its 2021 presidential election processes despite the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Simon Biabakama, the head of the Uganda Electoral Commission, says all public campaigns will be banned to slow the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic. According to a revised roadmap for the 2020-2021 general elections, Uganda will hold presidential elections between January 10th and February 8th next year. But some analysts say the move will only benefit incumbent candidates, including President Yoweri Museveni. Mugume Davis Rakaringi has details from Kampala.
While addressing journalists this Tuesday, Biabakama, the chairperson of Uganda's Electoral Commission, said the Electoral Commission came up with safety measures, including a ban on public rallies to contain the spread of the deadly coronavirus disease after consultations with experts from the Ministry of Health.
Owing to COVID-19 challenges and fears of spreading the virus, you cannot hold rallies. You have to use the available media.
He said the Electoral Commission has already lost some 3 months of the electoral process, including elections for people with special needs, such as youth and people with disabilities. According to the new roadmap, nomination for members of parliament will take place between 12th to 13th October this year, while that of presidential candidates will resume on 2nd and end on 3rd November this year. Campaigns for parliament, which will be conducted digitally, will resume on 20th October 2020 and end on 8th January next year. And presidential campaigns, which will also be conducted digitally, will take place between 10th November 2020 and end 8th January 2021.
The candidates will only emerge after nominations, and therefore, we have ample time to engage with all these actors, all these stakeholders, to ensure that the measures that the Commission has come up with in mitigation of the spread of the virus are realized, so that we have a free and fair process.
Crispe Kaheru, the former coordinator of NGO Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda, says the new arrangements will exclude many Ugandans.
The first-time candidates, first-time voters, have very little competitive chance with this new plan. We fear this roadmap may be rejected by a number of political players because it was not actually developed through a consultative manner. We are likely to see an apathy towards electoral activities and consequently a low voter turnout in the subsequent elections.
Joel Senyonyi, the spokesperson for the People Power Movement, a political pressure group in Uganda, agrees. He calls the actions of the Electoral Commission outrageous.
Only 28% of people have access to electricity. So 72% are in the dark. So they don't have any TV they are watching. So how do you tell candidates that they should go campaigning on television? Besides, even the available media houses, many of them are owned by, you know, state functionaries. But even those that are owned by decent business people, you'll find that opposition politicians are not allowed to go to those radio stations.
But Biabakama insists The Electoral Commission will come up with more comprehensive guidelines in the coming days. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
Malawi lawyers are holding a nationwide protest today, Wednesday, to support judicial independence. This comes after President Arthur Peter Mutharika asked Chief Justice Andrew Nyirenda to go on leave prior to the Chief Justice's retirement. President Mutharika has been criticized in the courts since they nullified in February this year the results of the 2019 presidential election and ordered fresh elections. The Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition, HRDC, has announced its support for the protest. HRDC lawyer Kumbo Soko says the judiciary is the defender of the constitution and the rule of law and should be independent from politics.
I think what we've seen over the last couple of months cannot be an accident. It is quite clear that it's a well-coordinated and, you know, lubricated campaign that is aimed at discrediting the judiciary for simply deciding that the presidential election that was held last year was full of irregularities, that its integrity was not trustworthy and guaranteed. So we're basically saying that in a democracy like the one we have here, our institutions of state should be allowed to operate without interference from the other institutions. In this particular case, the executive should not really be interfering with the operations of the judiciary.
I think it was last week that a high court judge granted an injunction requested by the Human Rights Defenders Coalition restraining President Mutharika's decision to send the Chief Justice on leave ahead of his retirement. Your comment on that?
That application was taken out of the abundance of caution that, they could do something, extremely irresponsible, which would have maybe permanently damaged the standing of the judiciary in the eyes of all right-thinking members of society. Especially there was information that these applicants had, that there were plans to seal off the office of the Chief Justice and the other Honourable Justice of Appeal so as to prevent them from accessing their office and discharging their constitutional duties. And for them, the thinking was that that was going to represent, a new law from which the judiciary was perhaps going to struggle to recover.
If I'm not mistaken, the president of Malawi has the constitutional right, if I'm not mistaken, to appoint judges of the Supreme Court. If that is the case, doesn't the president also have the right to terminate or even ask the Chief Justice to go on leave?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's their wish probably, but sadly for them, that's not the law. The law says that once a judge has been appointed by the president on the recommendation of the Judicial Service Commission, his or her tenure becomes secured. So he or she can only be removed from office on specified grounds of misbehavior or incompetence. And there is a procedure that must be followed. The judge must actually be impeached by the National Assembly, during which process he or she will also be given an opportunity to defend himself or herself against the allegations that are being leveled against him or her.
Back to the protest today, Wednesday. These are the days for the coronavirus. What measures are the protesters going to be taking to make sure that everybody is going to be safe?
The organizers have encouraged all participants to wear a face mask and also try to see if people can observe social distance. But, protest actions, sometimes that becomes a little tricky. But I know for a fact that everyone who will be attending will be expected to wear a face mask.
Kumbo Soko is the lawyer for the Human Rights Defenders Coalition of Malawi. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. A new report by a human rights group says repression by the Zimbabwe government is worsening under the pretext of enforcing coronavirus lockdown regulations. Ade Gondo has more from Harare.
The report by the Zimbabwe Peace Project, ZPP, that by the end of May, police arrested more than 40,000 people for defying lockdown regulations, mostly while trying to earn an income. The report says police made up 41.21% of the human rights violations, while the army contributed 22.26%. ZPP recorded 110 cases of harassment and intimidation, with most attributed to state security agents. There were also 13 cases of unlawful detention, 40 cases of assault, and 2 extrajudicial killings during the month of May alone. Harare recorded 100 cases of violations, the highest in the country, followed by Mashonaland East with 41 cases. Human rights lawyer Doug Coulthard welcomed the report and highlights what he calls the arbitrary and draconian enforcement of the lockdown regulations, including abuses of members of the opposition MDC party.
There have, of course, been the very high-profile cases. People have been killed, and where the lockdown has been used particularly to target political individuals, such as the three MDC women who are currently locked up at in Chikurubi. But there are literally thousands of other cases of less well-known people who are enduring horrific repression as a result of the arbitrary enforcement of the lockdown regulations. So it almost seems like the lockdown has become a greater threat to people than the virus that it's meant to protect against.
Coulthard was referring to the arrests of three members of the opposition MDC who were arrested and beaten on charges of violating the coronavirus lockdown rules. The Zimbabwe Human Rights NGO Forum publishes its own quarterly political and human rights violations report and chronicles a worsening human rights environment in the first quarter of the year. It singles out the alleged use of torture on civilians by police and called on officers to employ a human rights-based approach in their work. Coulthard says the human rights situation in the country since authoritarian President Robert Mugabe was forced from office in 2017 has not improved.
We keep having firsts with this new regime. I don't think that there has ever been the scale of the persecution of lawyers before, where we've had more than 10 lawyers arrested just in the space of 1 week. The use of the military and the police to unlawfully basically storm and take control of an opposition party headquarters is really unheard of, and unless we go as far back as the Gukurahundi era. ZAPU properties were taken by the Mugabe regime. The last decade or so of Mugabe's rule pales in comparison.
The country remains under work and travel restrictions to limit the spread of COVID-19, which began on March the 31st. Human rights defenders such as Coulthard say the fight against COVID-19 is necessary, but that rights to health, safety and clean water and access to information are routinely being violated, with security forces responding to lockdown violations with excessive force on civilians and harassment of the media. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo from Bulawayo.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington today. It's Wednesday, June 17th. Kenyan police say a police officer will face charges over the killing of a 13-year-old boy during enforcement of the coronavirus curfew. Yasin Moyo was shot in late March while standing on his family's apartment balcony in Nairobi, a tragedy that a police spokesperson described as an accident. But activists have accused Kenya police of brutality and unlawful killings. Lenny Rivaga reports from Nairobi.
Hussein and Hadija Moyo's 13-year-old son Yasin was shot and killed in late March during police enforcement of the coronavirus curfew. Moyo says he is relieved to hear that a policeman will face charges over his son's death. He says, my neighbor who witnessed the incident saw him steady his gun and take aim on his target. He then let loose his shot, Moyo says. By then, he says, my eldest daughter had told her mother, let's get away from this balcony, it's not safe. My wife then beckoned the children to get away, Moyo says. But by then, it was too late. Yasin had been hit by the bullet. A Kenyan police spokesman confirmed a policeman is to be charged over the teenager's death, but also described it as an accident.
We know he didn't do it intentionally, but still he has committed a crime of manslaughter or whatever. He has killed an innocent life because of his professional negligence. If he would have done his work professionally the way he's trained, we would have not lost that boy.
Kenyan protesters last week decried what they call years of police impunity and a jump in incidents of police brutality during the curfew. Hawa Hussein was one of hundreds who marched in Mathare, the poor neighborhood where Yasin Moyo was killed.
We are tired of police brutality. They are killing our youth, including my late husband. I have a young son, and by protesting, I am fighting for his future because the unlawful killings are constant and our voices are not being heard. Kenya's Independent Police Oversight Authority says five other police are facing charges over other deaths, injuries, and assaults that predate the COVID-19 curfew. The IPOA says it is investigating 15 deaths linked to police since March. But protester Rahma Waka said that is not enough. We thought that IPOA would level charges against more rogue officers whom we as a community know have committed unlawful killings, but nothing has happened. And that is why we ask ourselves, what powers do these police officers have? Since its 2012 launch, Kenya's IPOA has overseen the conviction of just seven officers for unlawful deaths despite dozens of killings linked to police. The Independent Police Oversight Authority did not have a spokesperson available to comment. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Tanzanian President John Magufuli has ordered the reopening of all schools in the country beginning June 29th. The schools had been closed due to the coronavirus pandemic. According to the World Health Organization, as of yesterday, June 16, Tanzania had about 509 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and 21 deaths. President Magufuli had been criticized for not taking the COVID-19 pandemic seriously. Neville Mina is the secretary for the Tanzania Editors Forum.
It has been received normally because, if you can recall, a few days ago he ordered to reopen the universities and the pharmacy students who are going to. It was expected that maybe any time the reopening of the.
According to the World Health Organization, as of yesterday, June 16, Tanzania had about 509 confirmed cases of coronavirus and 21 deaths. How do you think the president arrived at the decision to reopen all schools?
Yesterday, the prime minister delivered a speech in the parliament. He said that Tanzania had remained with only 66 patients. But the issue here is that the government has not been delivering any updates on the situation of the COVID-19 in the country. I can call it... The government had decided to say that we are through with the COVID-19.
Tanzania came under criticism last month from other leaders in the region, particularly because of Tanzania's COVID-19 policies or the lack of. How do you think this decision will be received in the East African Community region, particularly since Tanzania is going to be the first country to reopen all schools in the region?
The president stated categorically that we in the East Africa, we cooperate with the other countries, but we have our own way of dealing with our own issues. So he said categorically that despite of having international standards, WHO directives, but as a country, we must have our own way of dealing with our own issues. So that is his stand. It doesn't matter what will happen in terms of our neighbors like Kenya and Rwanda, who have been seen to be bitter when it comes to the trucker drivers entering their country, because they have stopped some trucker drivers even to cross the borders to those countries.
On the political front, the leader of Tanzania's main opposition, Chadema Party, Freeman Mbowe, was attacked earlier this month. How is he doing?
He was released from the hospital. He was discharged, and I have seen him addressing his followers at his residence in Dar es Salaam. And those followers went there to encourage him to be one of the presidential candidates in the next general elections. He was sitting, and he spoke about 15, 20 minutes to those followers. So from my eyes, he's doing fine, and... although he's still receiving some medication from doctors, maybe from Aga Khan Hospital.
Neville Mina is secretary for the Tanzania Editors Forum. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dar es Salaam. The self-proclaimed Ambazonia Republic, also known as the Cameroon Separatist Movement, says it is conducting a national drive to raise millions of dollars for its war effort. This comes as some observers say the movement is diminishing in fighting strength with little or no resources. The announcement comes also as the group is alleging that the Cameroon government is trying to change the constitution for President Paul Biya's son to succeed him and to have the vice president come from the English-speaking regions of the country. Chris Anu, the Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonia Republic, says the movement is rallying all Anglophone Cameroonians to raise more money to bring the war to a successful conclusion.
We are bringing Ambazonians from all the nooks and crannies of the globe together, county by county, local government by local government. Each county raises funds to prosecute the struggle in its county and in their local government.
So where are you recruiting from? From inside Cameroon or outside Cameroon? Because my understanding is that perhaps the strength of your fighters is diminishing with little or no resources.
If the strength of our fighters was indeed diminishing, as you suppose, don't you think by now a trained French Cameroon army could have declared victory? That they have not declared victory and they are not going to declare victory is evidence that we are holding on to our territory. They continue to lose their grip upon our territory by the day, and that tells you the strength of our own military. So, James, we are giving French Cameroon the fight of their life, and our only resolve is to arrive Boya, nothing else. Never again shall we have anything to share or in common with French Cameroon.
Yesterday, June 16, was the International Day of the African Child. Has your movement been recruiting child soldiers?
We are very conversant of what international law says as far as child soldier is concerned. No, we do not recruit child soldier. Our soldiers, they are men and women who are adults defending Ambazonia. But let me tell you the other side of the African Child's Day. The problem is the government that exists in La République du Cameroun has no conscience as to what a child is. You have had reports in the course of this struggle, in the course of this war, where French Cameroon has actually massacred children. Remember Ngarabu incident where they massacred 14 children.
During our conversation earlier, you said that the Cameroon government is trying to replace President Paul Biya with his son, and that the government was also in the process of changing the constitution to create the post of vice president from the English-speaking region. First of all, how true is this? And if that is true, would your movement be willing to lay down its arms?
No, James, not at all, because we are not fighting for a regime change in French Cameroon. We are fighting for a free and independent Ambazonia. And yes, those allegations are still there. In fact, right now, they have changed their setup at the Constitutional Council. They have installed a new constitutional lawyer or leader. And the allegations are still very rife that Frank Biya is going to replace his father as the new president of that country.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Ambazonian Republic of Cameroon. You're speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. And that's it for this Wednesday, June 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clouty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clouty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndumbulo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.